Hi everyone. You're about to hear a real-life horror story, and I want to guide you through it as safely as I can. I believe I have a responsibility beyond giving you a trigger warning, because many of you listening now will know the isolation of abuse and don't know where to turn. I want to give you a starting point that's free and accessible, a safe place for help, education and empowerment to join a global community of survivors. It's called STAR Network, which stands for Survivors of Toxic Abusive Relationships. And whether you've been in an abusive relationship, toxic workplace, or high conflict family, whatever it is, you can access a lifeline. You can sign up for daily TAR Anon meetings from your phone, that stands for Toxic Abusive Relationship Anonymous, and join this virtual trauma network and heal in connection. And if you want, you can share your story with others and feel heard. I'll put the details in the show notes as well, but it's starnetwork.org. STAR Network is a non-profit set up to give you the strength to break free, and it's an honour to have them as this episode sponsor. If you don't break the trauma will break you. Before we begin, you should know this is the podcast accompaniment to the documentary The Narcissist Playbook, and you're about to learn what really happened. The documentary is the tip of the iceberg of a story that's taken over my life, an investigation into one of the worst predators I've come across in my 30-year career. My name is Isla Traquair, and I'm an award-winning investigative journalist, and what you're about to hear is the stuff of nightmares. Except they aren't nightmares. And to steal the words of a diagnosed narcissistic psychopath, monsters do exist and they walk among us. This is The Storyteller, The Narcissist Playbook, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. Narcissism. How many of you have heard this term and think you know what it means? How many narcissists do you think you've come across in your life? How dangerous are they? Can they be cured? Can you escape if a narcissist has you in their clutches? These are just some of the questions that will be answered in this extensive deep dive into the very dark, complex and murky world of narcissism. You'll also join me, Isla Traquair, a crime journalist, as I track down and confront true evil. A man who wears a mask, who you've possibly seen on TV or online. I meet him face to face in a heart-racing encounter and confront him with multiple allegations of horrific abuse.
Do you feel bad for what you've done to these women?
When they come to you
and they're broken and they need help?
But before we dive in, a trigger warning that throughout this podcast, you're going to hear accounts of psychological, physical, and sexual abuse. You'll also hear stories of survival and recovery.
Really, honestly, Isla, I don't know how I survived. And I'm thinking I survived to see women like you, who can believe, who can trust, who can help to fight this evil.
Most importantly, you're going to learn from the world's leading experts and those with first-hand experience, so you can equip yourself with the knowledge and tools on what to do when you come face to face with a narcissist.
If you're with somebody, the way you feel with them is you're the only person that exists. Run.
I've been a journalist for nearly 30 years and I've had dealings with killers, psychopaths, rapists, you name it. And working on this project, understanding the mind motivations and goals of narcissists is like looking into an abyss.
Like, I thought I knew the depths of this person's darkness, and it's like a bottomless pit.
So strap yourselves in. The Narcissist Playbook is about to begin. What you're about to hear is disturbing. It's a voice note sent by a therapist to one of his patients, a young woman. One of many he's believed to have brainwashed, manipulated, coerced, threatened, sexually assaulted, deliberately infected with an STD. His name is Sam Vaknin. He admits himself, his ultimate heroine is to get someone to take their own life. Brace yourself, because it is unsettling.
Don't ever be in touch with me again. Do you fucking understand, you evil, evil demon creature, disgusting fucking psychopath?
That's not the full message, but you get the idea. He sent many like this to multiple patients, and it doesn't get any easier no matter how many times you hear it. It assaults the nervous system, especially if you've been on the receiving end of any kind of abuse. The full message has a threat of blackmail, consequences which could result in the patient's life being in danger. He knows which buttons to push. This is just one tiny sneak peek behind the mask of a man who presents himself to the world as a charming, slightly eccentric, charismatic professor who is educating the public about narcissism.
I provide my own brand of therapy, cold therapy, and I have a list of clients. And so healer, educator, activist, I try to play the other side. Try to see if I can obtain supply by being the good guy.
He doesn't hide the fact he's a diagnosed malignant narcissist. That's part of his shtick, his appeal. And it hits at the core of the mass fascination of psychology and true crime.
Would I have been able to be the good guy had I not been the bad guy? I don't think so. I think the bad guy was training for being the good guy.
Many of you listening now will relate to the unexplainable thirst to know about the dark side of humanity, and who better to hear it from than someone who is a narcissist.
I would strongly advise against having sympathy for narcissists under any pretext and so on.
Remember the words I used to describe him. Charming, eccentric, charismatic. These are not personality traits. These are manipulation tactics. Narcissists are chameleons. They have an ability to figure out exactly what you need them to be, to pull you in, so you can ultimately serve a purpose to them, which is entirely for their gain and your destruction. They are a wolf in savior's clothing, and at the point you realize their goal, it's probably already too late.
There is beauty, there is aesthetics in destroying another human being, in penetrating, in rearranging the furniture, the mental furniture, in taking over a mind.
You're going to hear the full awful story of this man and the abuse he inflicted on his many victims, and how my involvement came about when a documentary maker unwittingly stumbled upon a serial predator. And I know you'll be dying to hear the confrontation. But in order for you to truly understand his crimes and appreciate the 2.5 hour exchange I have with him, you must first understand what narcissistic personality disorder is.
So there's a lot of confusion around it, because narcissism in and of itself is a personality style. It's not a diagnosis, it's not a disorder, it's a personality style. And it is characterized by multiple things that sort of simultaneously have to be present. And these include sort of key pillars, including low variable performative empathy. So it's not the absence of empathy. The narcissistic people actually can often have what seems and feels like empathy. It's often cognitive empathy, and it's often, like I said, quite performative. The second piece is entitlement and grandiosity, the almost delusional belief that they are special, that they are to be accorded special treatment, that they are unique. And that entitlement extends to violating other people's boundaries and almost a sense of they shouldn't even have to face consequences. The third is an excessive need for admiration and validation. Excessive being the operative word here. And so they will go to excessive lengths to ensure they get it. And whatever that looks like. And it could, in a more malignant form, could be even taking advantage of other people so that then the validation is their sense of power. But it's this excessive need to be seen and noticed and told that they're wonderful and all of that. The next one is pathological selfishness. And I'm saying pathological because, I mean, listen, everyone has a selfish moment. But by pathological, I really mean it is a self-centeredness and an egocentricity to the detriment of other people. You know, and it kind of really ties in with that entitlement piece. And the last is emotional dysregulation. And that can show up either as rage that's very, very much expressed through violence, through yelling, through screaming. Can also be passive-aggressive rage, silent treatment, withholding, withdrawing. And so the dysregulation of strong emotion, especially at times of frustration, disappointment, stress, or not getting that admiration and validation, can show up as these emotions that are not well managed, and they're often quite, like I said, dysregulated. You pretty much need all of those things for someone to be narcissistic.
That's the voice of Dr. Romani Durvasula. If you type into a search engine, who's the number one expert in narcissism in the world, her name comes up. If you're on the internet and you've seen anything on this topic, you'll likely know who she is. Her career as a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology led her to the niche of narcissism because so many of her therapy clients' problems related to narcissistic people in their lives. It became her specialism long before narcissism became a buzzword. And as she explains, there's a big difference between someone who is selfish and self-obsessed and someone with NPD.
So if somebody is just selfish, they're selfish. But if they're not, if they're selfish, but they actually do quite often have intact empathy, or they're not entitled. They're just sort of like, oh, I do things the way I do them. And they might even make choices in their life. They don't get married. They don't have kids. Like, I just like doing things the way I want. And I didn't want to hurt anyone else. I guess that person's selfish, but they certainly wouldn't be called entitled or unempathic. So that we need them all. And we are overusing the term. Now, this idea of narcissistic personality disorder is sort of the fly in the ointment, because it's a diagnostic formulation that's actually kind of unnecessary. Very few people receive the diagnosis, because very few people with these traits will end up in a therapist's office. And when they do, it's usually for some other presenting issue, addiction, attention deficit disorder, depression, anxiety. There's something else going on. And usually the clinician will remain more focused on that state. A person would have to be evaluated over a relatively long period of time for a therapist often to definitively issue that diagnosis. There's a lot of people out there with narcissistic personalities that will never get diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorders. And there are some people out there who have been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder, and their narcissism isn't even that severe. So getting the diagnosis doesn't imply that the person has more severe narcissism. It merely means that for some reason they got to a clinician's office, and for some reason that clinician was willing to give them that diagnosis, but there's nothing systematic about that.
Because so few narcissists would ever seek a diagnosis, it's impossible to know how many people have NPD. But Dr. Romani estimates it's 1 in 4.
And there's different types of narcissists. Can you take me through those, please?
Yeah, there are different types of narcissism. And I think that this is what takes us, again, this construct that's being talked about so much, but there's so much subtlety. We also have to remember, before I even get into the subtypes, that narcissism is on a continuum from mild to severe. And at the mild end, we're really talking about people who are much more, they have all the stuff of narcissism, but it's usually the pathological selfishness that tends to be the most central in their presentation, the entitlement, there is a immaturity and, emotional stuntedness that can feel quite frustrating and annoying. That's very different than what we see at the more severe ends of the spectrum, where we see a more malignant narcissism, where it is much more exploitative, coercive, menacing, isolating, severe manipulation. So that's the continuum. Now, on that continuum, we have different subtypes. Most prominently, we have sort of the grandiose subtype, which is often traditionally viewed as what narcissism is. It's the arrogant, charming, charismatic, preening, extroverted, attention-seeking narcissistic person. These are people who are very egotistical, very egocentric, but they can also be quite compelling. And these people are often quite successful, and they do well in dating, and they do well in business, and they do well in leadership. And in fact, those grandiose defenses can often even be quite protective for them. This is in contrast to the vulnerable narcissist. Vulnerable narcissism is characterized by a person who has all those things of narcissism I spoke about, but they're packaged up as much more of an aggrieved, disenchanted, angry, socially anxious, sullen, petulant, passive-aggressive, victimized presentation. Why doesn't anyone give me more credit? I deserve more credit. The world is against me. That kind of thing. Every narcissistic person who's grandiose has a touch of the vulnerable that could come out if things don't go well for them. And every narcissistic person who's predominantly vulnerable could have a touch of the grandiose if things did start going well for them. Another subtype of narcissism is called malignant narcissism. This tends to be a more severe form of narcissism. Much more, again, like I said, malignant is much more exploitative and coercive. Malignant narcissistic people may not have that sort of charming, charismatic exterior, nor will they have that kind of dysphoric, sad, anxious presentation of the vulnerable narcissistic person. So malignant narcissism often is more in line with what we call the dark tetrad personality style, where we see kind of the confluence of narcissism, psychopathy, Machiavellianism, and sadism. And I'd even throw in there sort of suspiciousness and low-grade paranoia. That's what we'd see in a malignant narcissistic person. It can feel like psychopathy, but it's not the same. Then there's a form of narcissism called communal narcissism, which is really only written about in the last 20 years. Communal narcissistic people kind of get their supply, if you will. They get their admiration and validation by being perceived as being sort of do-gooders and doing good in the world. And so they posture and position themselves as being these sorts of saviors, rescuers, like I said, do-gooders. But in fact, they engage in all the harmful machinations of a narcissistic person. But they're often quite tricky to detect, and people will sometimes feel guilty. This is someone who will be viewed as a pillar of the community, but is actually quite unkind to close family members, partners. And when you take the communal and the malignant and mix them together, you have something that looks like a cult leader. Then when you have the self-righteous narcissism, these are people who are very morally judgmental, morally rigid. They're very miserly with money. They're very dismissive. It's really, they're sort of these very locked into this hyper rigid structure. And the lack of empathy really shows up as a coldness and a dismissiveness. Either you do it my way or you don't. There's very little empathy for people who are struggling and often a likelihood to blame them. So you can see with all these different types of narcissism, a person who's in a relationship with a mild self-righteous narcissist and somebody who's in a relationship with a severe malignant narcissist, they're having very different experiences. While the core of it remains the same, it can feel different. It's also important to remember that at the core of all narcissism is very much an ego, a fragile ego, a sense of shame, lots of shame that's easily activated, and an insecurity. And when that narcissistic shame gets pinged, it gets activated by someone, they're criticized, they're found out, they don't get the promotion, they don't have as nice a car as somebody else. That shame comes up. And instead of it being managed through vulnerability and regulation, they lash out at the person who brought up the shame. Rather, they're not taking accountability for the bad thing they did. They get mad at the person who pointed out the bad thing.
No matter where a narcissist lies on the spectrum, there's an almost identical process of pulling in their prey, indoctrinating, seizing control, isolating, intermittent reinforcement and discard. It's not linear, and the push-pull phase can go on for years, even a lifetime. You'll see evidence of this later in the series from actor and activist Evan Rachel Wood, who was physically and psychologically tortured by former partner Brian Warner, better known as Marilyn Manson.
I didn't feel like I had a choice, and I really did think he was going to kill me.
Doug Buggle was married to a female narcissist for 12 years, and had no clue he'd been abused until he got free.
You have withdrawals just as the same as if you were being cut off from heroin and there was no more supply.
A diagnosed female narcissist will openly reveal her goals
all men want to save us. You are so easy to manipulate.
And a diagnosed psychopath, H.G. Tudor, will reveal the secrets of his kind.
I am what you would understand to be an evil person, and I haven't got a shred of redemption about me.
This podcast is going to be one of the most comprehensive examinations into narcissism to date. And the key story of Sam Vaknin is the stuff of nightmares. You'll also learn about his nemesis.
My name is Mark Vicente. I am a filmmaker. I have made both feature films, narrative, documentaries. I'm most well known for a film years and years ago called What the Bleep Do We Know, about spirituality and quantum mechanics and all kinds of weird things. And that weirdness led me into a number of cults.
You might know Mark from the documentary series The Vow. For more than a decade, Mark's life was taken over by the cult Nexium. In 2020, Mark and his wife Bonnie played a key role in getting the cult leader Keith Raniere jailed for 120 years. I'm telling you this because Mark's healing journey is why you're listening to me now. His experience with Nexium led him to investigate narcissistic personality disorder, the cult leader having demonstrated almost every trait. And while making the film, The Narcissist Playbook, he came across diagnosed malignant narcissist Sam Vaknin, who is claiming to be helping victims of narcissistic abuse. He's Israeli but lives in northern Macedonia. He's 63 years old and married to a Macedonian called Lydia. His wife is also his publisher and used in the grooming. Sam's online popularity grew after he teamed up with British psychologist Richard Grannan, who's a survivor of narcissistic abuse from his childhood.
My name is Richard Grannan. I work as a psychologist and I help people to protect themselves against psychological predators.
Sam and Richard were a good double act, a survivor and a predator, holding seminars in many countries with the goal of educating people. They were both filmed extensively for the documentary. What Richard didn't know was that Sam was using him as a validation tool to give him access to the perfect hunting ground. My involvement came about after multiple victims of Sam contacted Mark and Richard to inform them of a series of horrific allegations of abuse carried out while they were receiving so-called therapy from Sam. He'd been boasting to his victims that he was the star of a high-profile documentary, adding to his accreditations and status, meaning they would be less likely to be believed. He was hoping his rising credibility would ensure their silence. Instead, it broke his cover and opened the floodgates. You'll hear the full roller coaster story and witness through me the downfall of a predator. But before you hear from the victims and Mark, you need to understand the impact of narcissistic abuse. Because when I state this is a story of a therapist who abused his patients, it's far too easy to look to blame the victims. They should have known better, right? Absolutely not. The trust placed in a therapist is extreme. Patients open up to their therapist more than anyone else in their life. They're supposed to be the safest, most trusted, impartial, objective professional to assess, treat, and guide them through their healing. Sam did the exact opposite. As a therapist herself, Dr. Romani recognises why Sam's victims were sitting ducks.
Somebody exploiting a therapeutic role is actually, it's the ultimate grift. If somebody goes into therapy and they're resistant, if anything, we criticize that person. Why are you holding back? And yet holding back is the only protection we've got in a narcissistic relationship. So it's in essence, you know, using the trust of that office. And it's been done in many professions where that person should have been safe, you know, even in religious positions, right? That was exploited and taken advantage of and people were harmed horribly. And so it's the ultimate, to me, it's one of the ultimate human rights crimes when somebody takes a position of what should be trust and uses that to exploit another human being.
Dr. Romani is aware of Sam Vaknin and how he markets himself online. She's seen the full documentary, and I gave her further details of his modus operandi and the violations, which you have yet to hear. One of the most important things for you, the listeners, to understand before you hear the detail of what happened is the impact of psychological abuse. Something to note, when she says narcissistic relationship, she's not just meaning romantic.
I think the reason that a lot of people struggle with understanding what the experience is of a person in a narcissistic relationship is that one of the reflexive responses is, well, they're not tying you up. They haven't locked you up. They're not hitting you. So get out, leave. And so there's the sense that a person, there's no appreciation of how manipulation and coercion and gaslighting can play on a person's psyche, especially if they care about or attach to or connected to the narcissistic person. I think another factor in play is that a lot of narcissistic qualities and traits, especially things like the charm, the charisma, those are socially valued. So the people who possess narcissistic traits are often socially valued. In fact, it's beyond the charm and the charisma and the financial success. One kind of sort of excuse I often hear employed with narcissistic folks, they're so smart. This person's so smart. As though smart is a virtue. Smart is smart. It's not a virtue. And so, but because of what can feel like a tremendous intellect or something like that, people will think, well, that person can't be doing anything bad because a smart person wouldn't hurt someone, which is a ridiculous assertion, but sure. I also think that because narcissistic people have what I call sort of a public-private personas, and they're very different. In public, the narcissistic person can actually seem quite engaging, quite compelling, quite interesting. So somebody who's in a close relationship with them, it's almost implausible to other people that this person could be awful to them. Like, oh, come on, I've never had a problem with them, is what people will hear. And what happens behind closed doors is absolutely terrible. And it can switch like that, so much so that the survivor doubts themselves. And that takes us to the main reason. People who have gone through these relationships question themselves. Maybe I'm not seeing this wrong. Maybe I'm to blame. Maybe I'm asking too much. Maybe I'm being too needy. And the self-blame piles up so much that many people who are in narcissistic relationships either feel complicit or they feel as though they're the problem or they're the perpetrator. Put all of that together and you have people who are deeply confused by your relationship, and the sort of prevailing wisdom in the world is like, well, if it feels like such a problem, get out. But it's not that simple, because the manipulations of this relationship can often leave people feeling as though they're worthless, they're crazy, there's something wrong with them, and that can make people very reluctant to be able to leave.
How would you describe to the listeners the, you know, what psychological abuse can actually do to someone, how damaging it is and how long it might take to recover from?
So I think that this has been a long-standing problem in the field. Listen, it's only in the last 30, 35 years, give or take, that we've started according trauma in all its forms, maybe 40 years, that we've started according trauma in all its forms, the gravitas and the seriousness it deserves. I mean, for the longest time, we didn't even recognize what it was. We would, whether it was combat veterans, whether it was women who were sexually assaulted, we did not even register. It's like, the thing is done, it's happened, now get over it kind of thing, and couldn't understand why these were people who were struggling so much after their trauma. Well, this is no different. And even now, we do not accord emotional and psychological abuse the same sort of the same level of recognition, which is unfortunate because we know from a mental health perspective, it has equal effects to all other forms of abuse. Because ultimately, the body, the nervous system, only know that safety has been disrupted, whether this has happened through psychological means, whether this happens through sexual means, whether this happens through physical means, the person doesn't feel safe. And the body reacts to that lack of safety quite similarly. And so but in the absence of these bruises, there's always been this tendency to say that, well, all relationships are tough, or there's two sides to every story. And because so much of the abuse cycle disproportionately affects women, there's historically been the tendency to view a woman's report of what's happened to her as a result of emotional abuse. Go back to Freud, it was called hysteria. It was literally the pathologizing of female anatomy. So it was basically, oh, that overly emotional woman. And so the person who was being harmed was then being re-harmed and being told that this is nothing, or you're being ridiculous, or you're overreacting. So we don't accord it. We don't account for it. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Some of them are sociological, again, related to, you know, patriarchy, related to, you know, anti-women bias. All of those things are at play. But it is, again, it feels less measurable. And I think that we've always viewed it through too relativistic a lens, like, different relationships have different styles. No, any relationship where someone feels psychologically unsafe, where they cannot show up as their true selves, where if they express a need, they will be shut down. If they question what's happening, they are not only shut down, but perhaps harmed. Where people, again, what I always say narcissistic abuse is, it's a prison where the door is wide open and there's no way to leave. And because that door is wide open, many people will say, you could go. There's nothing stopping you. And yet I'm saying this might as well be the most secure prison in the world for how unlikely it is for people to get out of this. I think that psychological and emotional abuse actually imprisons people in a way unlike any other form of abuse, because a person is sort of locked into a belief system that is not theirs, and it's projected onto them by someone else who has convinced them that there's something so damaged about them and that they could not survive without the narcissistic person.
Thank you for articulating that so beautifully, because it's something I do struggle with, and it's something that all victims struggle with, to try and actually explain why. Because when I have tried to, let's say, to a friend explain what I'm working on, and the general kind of basis story, well, there's this therapist and he's very well known in the public, and he's on YouTube, and he says he's got as high an IQ as Einstein, and then he becomes their therapist, and then he brainwashes them, then he ends up having sex with them. But, you know, he's essentially raping them, though, because they, in a conscious mind, would never ever have agreed to do what they end up doing. And then it goes on for a long time, and then they're destroyed, and then he discards them. He tries to get them to kill themselves. The immediate thing is for people to judge that. How can we get people to understand? I mean, you did just say, to articulate it beautifully about the prison analogy there, but I mean, how many of your patients have you seen go from, you know, whatever their life is, and then end up in situations where they're like, I never ever, ever would have imagined I'd end up, you know, in this situation?
Lots. I mean, I think it's everyone in a narcissistic relationship. Obviously, the examples you're giving of people being severely sexually exploited, of suffering such trauma that it's culminating in not only isolation, but even a command to do harm to themselves. This is obviously at the most severe levels of narcissistic, you know, what we call narcissistic abuse, or the harms that come in any form of antagonistic relationship. What people need to remember, though, is that these relationships aren't that the day one a person comes in menacing and assaults someone and tells them to end their lives. That's not what's happening. It's a very, very slow process of indoctrination. Then particularly the more malignant narcissistic people. I don't think this is all forms of narcissism by any stretch, but in a more malignant form of narcissism, they're studying the other person, right? So they're ultimately going to, especially when they're trying to, you know, indoctrinate them in this way, they're studying them. And they're playing, and that person, the malignant narcissistic person, is playing on vulnerabilities in that person, right? But initially, they're also playing on yearnings, right? Telling a person, being that what they've always needed, right? So whatever those core wounds are, it's like we'd see in any cultic system. The cultic system shows up and offers the thing that the person is craving, and makes them feel as though they are chosen and special and a part of something special. And so when that is something that somebody desperately needs, which is why a malignant narcissistic person who's preying on someone might prey on someone who's disenfranchised, who may be distanced from other sources of social supports, who may be struggling with a mental health issue. And that's not to say everyone who gets pulled into this, sometimes people don't have any of those things going on, and they could be vulnerable simply because they find there to be something compelling about this person who's indoctrinating them. Maybe they have a shared belief system. Whatever it is, it's a slow process. Trust is slowly built up. Attachment is slowly fostered. And as those ties get built, then the malignant narcissistic person is in a position to exploit those ties. And what they'll often do is go back and forth. They'll tell them they're wonderful and they'll tell them they're terrible. They'll tell them they're wonderful and then they'll do harm to them. And that going back and forth between those two poles, that intermittent reinforcement, that reinforces something called a trauma bond, which very much confuses the person in the relationship who does feel some sense of specialness, connection, being seen by this person, and are told sometimes even that the harmful moments are meant to build character. This is making you stronger. So the abuse is framed as something that is quote unquote good for them. It is the most vile, inhumane thing a person can do when they're abusing someone is literally gaslighting them and telling them this terrible thing I'm doing to you is good for you. At that point, the person being harmed feels a sense of complicity. I'm part of this. They literally almost feel like a perpetrator. You'll see that they're experiencing a sense of moral injury, that they're the one doing a bad thing. And at that point, it's very, very difficult for them to break out of that cycle. If you feel like you're the perpetrator, you're not going to go seek out help. You're going to think that you're the same as this person who's harming you. And what also gets lost is what we call a sense of agency, because the malignant narcissistic person is stealing the autonomy and the individuation of that other person. They're stealing that other person's sense of self. And so that person is then in sort of enthrall to that narcissistic person. And they have lost themselves in it, because if they had any sense of self, that would get shut down, right? That's what the narcissistic person is trying to dismantle. When that gets dismantled, what has now been done is that the malignant narcissistic person has pretty much forced this person, I don't want to use the word victim, let's call them a survivor, into a sense of forced dependency onto the narcissistic person. So now the person being harmed feels a sense of shame. They feel a sense of complicity. They feel a sense of dependency. So it's like every imaginable way one could relate to someone happens that in a relationship. And now the narcissistic person is harming them, but the prison door is open. And so even when law enforcement and other authorities get involved, they're saying, well, this person wasn't kept against their will. You know, they were able to leave. They weren't jumped in an alley or something like that. Like, they were voluntarily going to an appointment. And this is where our justice systems are not trauma informed, because it's actually not consensual. They are not just going in. They really have, in essence, it's sort of a psychological hijacking that happens in these relationships. And because so many people aren't trauma-informed, people are afraid that if I go do tell someone, and some survivors do go talk to other people, people either look at them sideways or say, listen, there's nothing we can do here. No law is being broken. You're going into a room with this person and you're having sex with them. That's what they're being told. So there's this implication of consensual relationship where it's not. It's deeply manipulative. And as we do more research on coercive control and emotional abuse and what happens in these relationships, we're understanding it more. But I'm telling you now, our legal systems have not come anywhere near to catching up to this. And so the people who are caught in these cycles, who are slowly indoctrinated, who are dismantled brick by brick, are viewed as being foolish and getting lost, when in fact, anyone would be vulnerable to this if they were subjected to that series of steps.
One of the most shame-inducing elements of Sam Vaknin's abuse is sexually assaulting the women under the guise of what he calls cold therapy. This might be one of the hardest aspects for people to understand, but Dr. Romney recognises the imbalance of trust and power that led to this horrific violation.
When harm is undertaken in a relationship that is predicated on trust, therapy is a fantastic example of that, right? That it is there's a tremendous vulnerability. That's why we as therapists in the United States, I can only speak about where I am, we must adhere to a very, you know, complex set of legal and ethical regulations for good reason. Because our job is to create a safe space for individuals who are going through something vulnerable and honor the therapeutic frame. We're not the client's friend, right? We're not inviting them for dinner. As much as we may care for a client and recognize, oh, housing would make a big difference, we don't say, hey, I found a rental for you. Like, we don't do that. We have a very, very clear role. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to foster a sense of autonomy in the client, for them to recognize that there's a them outside of the therapy room. Never foster dependency. In the United States, in California at least, the state, you know, where I practice, it's against the law to, and it is punishable by prison if a person has sexual contact with a patient. And that's a very severe violation. And in fact, us as therapists, if we find out a patient comes in and says, I had sex with my prior therapist, we have to follow a series of steps, right? So that's a very, very, very severely and rightfully so adjudicated space. In fact, even if you terminate with a patient, there's a window of time during which you can't even have that kind of contact with them. And I'm a firm believer that that should never, ever be the case. It's a very, very unique relationship. And I think to the end of our days must be respected in that way. So all of that said, when a person goes into relationships where there's a predication of trust, healthcare provider, therapist, maybe even other professions like a lawyer or something like that, there are presumptions that this person is going to protect the other person. And so under that presumption of protection, a person may end up being quite compliant with demands that may not feel reasonable. And if that person may be at all isolated, let's say the person who's coming in for a therapeutic relationship with a predatory therapist is not living in their home country, or they are away from sources of support, there may be no place to ask the question to. There may also be shame around that. It could be that person has a trauma history already, so there's distortion around trust and relationship and all of those things. So there's a lot of things that a predatory person in a sort of a therapeutic or healing kind of a position can play upon to take advantage of a person and do tremendous harm. So what people see from the outside, though, and since time immemorial, they see a person who's going along with a series of demands, and we then assume that that's consensual. But like I said, until these systems become trauma-informed, they're actually not. They're playing on certain variables like trust, like power asymmetries, and even vulnerability, because when people enter therapy, there is some form of vulnerability. So these things are capitalized on in these kinds of situations. And so I don't know that we can fully call these things consent. And in the United States, again, if a person enters therapy, we have very clear consent procedures. So a person receives a many, many page document, and they're told exactly what this process will entail and what their rights are and what to expect, and even numbers they can call to report complaints. In the absence of that, many clients don't know that that's a, if you're not given this opportunity for informed consent, then this is not, you know, that this is not okay. But in the absence of all that, which many people wouldn't know, then again, there's such an opportunity for exploitation. And so it's really taking advantage of that. But that's how people get pulled in. It's not foolishness. It's not stupidity. It's not anything like that. It is literally somebody taking advantage of a position of trust, capitalizing on that, and moving slowly through that, through all those psychological means I've talked about. And then you have a very, very dangerous situation.
It is very dangerous. And I feel, you know, everything I've learned, he is a very, very dangerous man. Where do you think he lies in the scale on the spectrum of narcissism, and what type would you think he might be?
Listen, if a person, and I'm going to speak in general terms, I don't even have to speak about this specific person because I'm in a position where I really can't, but if a person is taking advantage of an office of trust to exploit people, to compel them to end their lives, to slowly indoctrinate them into a belief system where they're living in terror and fear and perhaps even blaming themselves, We can put that at the most severe level of narcissism and put that in the sort of that place of malignant narcissism. And so again, you can see though how this is in contrast to what many other people endure in the narcissistic space. And it confuses people. They'll hear a story like this, they'll say, well, I'm not going through this. This isn't what's happening to me. I've got a partner at home who lies to me a lot and doesn't ever help and calls me lazy and makes fun of me. Like, that's not this. But some of the core elements are the same. It's invalidating. The person might feel stuck, all the things. But this kind of stuff where people are literally being put in harm and being isolated and being, you know, and being driven to a place of such despair in such a sadistic way, it goes to that dark tetrad presentation of the narcissism, psychopathy, Machiavellianism, sadism, and how those traits all interconnect. That's why it's very difficult to sort of say, this is this, but it's rather to see that these personality traits all sort of interact. And when they do, especially at that severe end, I don't see where this ends up anywhere but dangerous.
Is there anything that you could say to the victims, and there'll be some of them that will hear you in this podcast, to comfort them? Because there is such an incredible level of shame, blame, a sense that they've agreed to it, that it's their fault, they were part of the tango. What would you say to them now?
That this is absolutely not your fault. You're not responsible for any of this. As I say to everyone, it's not you. That the healthiest parts of yourselves, empathy, compassion, the willingness to attach, the willingness to trust, were preyed upon. The best parts of you were taken advantage of. So that's not your complicity. That's you having trust in the world, which sadly is something we kind of need, because it's hard to go through the world if you don't trust anybody. And so the narcissistic person in any relationship projects all their bad stuff onto the other person. As Dan Shaw so brilliantly puts it, we sort of become the carrier. We become, I always say, we carry the backpack of the narcissistic person's shame. And we have to give, we have to take that backpack off and hand it right back to them. To all of the survivors, I want to say, this is not your burden to carry. You didn't do these things. A person came and exploited the kindest parts of yourself. Listen, even in the most ancient of myths, you know, think about the story of Little Red Riding Hood. That's your original narcissism story, right? The wolf dresses up and plays on Red Riding Hood's kindness and then tries to eat her. And so that's it. I mean, we've been telling this story for hundreds and hundreds of years because it's been happening since forever. And so, and I would say to the anyone watching this, do you blame Red Riding Hood, or do you blame the wolf?
I have no doubt the wolf is the deceiver, the predator wearing the mask. The wolf in this story admits he's a wolf, but one who's self-aware and telling the world how wolves choose, ensnare and devour their prey, even how you can escape and heal. All the while, he's still being a wolf. Even at the time of this recording, Sam Vaknin is hunting. In the next episode of The Narcissist Playbook, filmmaker Mark Vicente describes the moment his educational documentary turned into a real-life horror.
The can of worms that begins opening up, he is evil, and they begin telling me what he's done to them. And I was like, oh, shit.
One of their main experts was leading a dual life.
Because this is not the case of somebody who's a bad guy who reformed and who basically teaches people how to avoid people like him. This is a man who's still doing all those horrible things while teaching people about horrible people like himself.
And what happened when he asked me to go after the predatory professor?
And I just remember how fast you said yes. It was just like, yes, sounds great. And I'm like, holy shit.
The Storyteller Narcissist Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. and it's the fourth in the Storyteller series. This is an independent production, and I rely on you, the listeners, to help spread the word by showing your support. It doesn't cost anything, just a few clicks to like, share, subscribe, and review. And soon there'll be extra content available on my Patreon for the price of a cup of coffee, including analysis, evidence, regular videos, and more. Thank you for listening.